Hello and welcome to the Toncast. As always, I'm your host, Andrew Burlinson. Before I introduce my very special guest, I want to answer some listener emails. Mom, I will be up for Christmas, but not for Thanksgiving. So that's the only email I got. And without further ado, here is my very special guest, Todd Anderson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's nice now that your mom knows when she'll get to see you.
I know.
And you're making the right choice.
I think so.
Like, if you're going to travel on a holiday, you do it on Christmas.
Yeah.
Not on Thanksgiving.
I'm from New York, and I lived in Chicago for a bunch of years, and I didn't even get to go home for Thanksgiving for, like, 7 years. So I think Thanksgiving's been kind of undone. It's been unholidayed. And so Christmas is, like, the big one where we try to be together, but then my brother and sister have in-laws. They have to time it out. Who gets what family, what year.
Right, right.
So, we're going up this year.
Good.
All my family lives in Northern California. You were asking about this, so that's why I'm telling you.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. Well, when I was back east, when I was in college, I would go, because I was in New York and I grew up in Massachusetts, so I would get back all those holidays.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Sherburn, Massachusetts.
Where's that?
How well do you know?
A little bit.
It's like basically a half hour west of Boston.
A half hour west of Boston.
A half hour.
pull out the draw.
At the time anyway, it was the outermost ring of suburbs. Really
Before
small town. It became, when my parents moved in there, there was nobody there.
Okay.
But by the time I graduated high school, it was basically Beverly Hills,
whoa,
Massachusetts.
Boomtown.
All the wealthy people built their mansions and whatnot there.
My dad would spend his summers out in Chatham.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
sure.
And many, many years later, my family rented his childhood home as a vacation home. And he was saying similar situation where when he lived there, he said this was the only house up on this hill and those were all dunes. And then it was just all like packed with houses and everything had been completely filled in with other people.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but I love it back there. This is the time of year where it's hard. I miss it a lot. I don't get homesick for the East Coast, but like fall weather.
I miss the autumn. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always daydream about taking that trip back, but my wife's in school, my son's in school, they're in school, so there's no time to go. And by Thanksgiving is really a little too late for the leaves.
So push college on the East Coast to your son.
Yeah, so we can get back there. Sure, why not?
Here's some brochures for Dartmouth and Harvard.
I'm actually sending my son to trade school when he's 14.
Oh, good.
So he'll be out of school by the time, and in a job by the time he's 16.
What trade are you aiming for?
That I'm leaving up to him. Electrician, although that's one of the most dangerous jobs.
It is.
In the country. It's more dangerous than being a cop, I guess.
It is?
Apparently, in rankings.
That's interesting.
But plumber's probably good.
The union. It's good.
Yeah, and I feel like plumber's the way to go, because if you go electrician, you know, when the end times happen,
uh-huh,
and the power grids go out,
uh-huh,
there's no work for you.
Right.
Like, electricity's gone.
Right.
But there'll still be plumbing that works. People still need to take shits, right?
And when during the end times, all money will be useless, and so it'll be a barter system.
Right.
People will need to take shit, and they'll need water, so your son will get food, shelter, and favors.
In exchange.
So that'll be a good situation.
Yeah.
When all society has collapsed.
I plan everything around the collapse of society.
You're kind of like a helicopter parent, but I'm not judging you at all.
We're on the cusp of potential end times right now. We'll see what happens in November. But it could go south.
It's so funny.
Depending on who you talk to,
yeah,
it's going to go south either way.
I was listening to NPR, and somebody said, or I, Actually, that's not true. I'm lying. A friend who was listening to NPR relayed the story to me that she heard someone say that he's gathering a militia in case Hillary Clinton wins. If Hillary Clinton wins, he's going to mobilize his militia, which is so...
Trump is going to mobilize a militia if he loses?
No, this guy.
This other guy.
Some guy being interviewed in, like, Riverside, California. He's like, well, you know, I'm a big Trump supporter, and my neighbors and I are gathering up our militia just in case Hillary wins. Why?
What are they going to do with their militia?
And what will happen? Why do you believe that everything will collapse if this person is elected president? Whereas if Trump is elected president, things, I think, could genuinely collapse.
No, things will collapse if he's elected. Actually, as a non-gun owner,
yeah,
and an anti-gun dude, if Trump wins, the first thing I'm doing is buying a gun.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go out and buy a gun.
When he was talking during the debate, what I could decipher from what he was saying, one of the things he actually said that made sense, in the English language sense of making sense, was that he, when he answered why, what would you do to help racial healing, he wants to promote stop and frisk as a way of promoting racial... I didn't understand how those two things... Well, he said law and order, and then he went to stop and frisk. Okay, that's not in any way a healing technique that I know of.
No. I mean...
And B...
It depends on the frisker and the frisky.
Stop and frisk. Now, be more specific. Is this a police officer frisking me? Who is frisking, and is it me, or who...
I think it's any white person can stop and frisk any person of another of ethnic background.
Okay.
Wow. A person of color can be stopped and frisked at any time by a white person, and that is going to help racial relations.
So I'm an undecided voter. if I were a black man or a Latino man, I would be pretty scared right now. This is unbelievably ridiculous to me.
It is insane. Although, have you seen that I posted this on my Facebook feed the other day? There's a Tecate
beer,
commercial. Not a fan of the beer, personally. Me, it's not my kind of beer.
No, okay.
But I am a huge fan of that company now because they made an ad, and it's a Mexican ad. It's in Mexican TV, but it starts with like a bunch of white guys standing and just looking at a wall, a giant wall separating Mexico. They got like stretches from the you know, as far as the eye can see, and then you see some Mexicans with some beers, and they approach the wall, and the white guys approach the wall, and then they crack the beers and they put them down on the wall because the wall is only like 4 feet high.
Okay.
And they just have a beer party at the wall.
Perfect.
And the thing is like, yeah, let's build this wall. That's why awesome. Not
as
we'll hang out and have wall beer.
As a beer deck. Yeah. That's like the I Want to Buy a World of Coke commercial.
Yeah.
Updated for our times.
Yeah. It was, I think it's a great ad.
I think that's important. I think that you should spread that word, spread that ad.
Yeah.
Buy Tecate.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not going to drink, just to clarify, I won't drink Tecate.
Uh-huh.
But I'll bring some other micro-brewed beers, American beers.
From America.
Yeah.
From the United States.
To share at the wall.
Sure.
With people who mostly drink Tecates.
A cultural exchange.
Right, exactly.
So it'll support cultural exchange.
Yeah, exactly.
This Trump guy.
He's got
more appealing by the minute,
yeah,
Todd.
If you really break it down. If you can get past the vicious racism and for the longest time I was trying to avoid saying that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have enough Trump supporters in my life, you know, that I didn't want to
admit
offend them with that and, you know, make the broad stroke of anyone who votes for Trump is a bigot.
Right.
Because they don't see themselves that way.
No.
But bigots never do.
Right.
They never do. And so, but now I'm past it.
Yeah.
I'm past the dialogue. Like, I even said, just as recently as a couple weeks ago, somebody, you know, on, on Facebook had this whole thing about, you know, you've really got to... Hi, Ginny. My cat Ginny wants me to throw her bracelet. She gets... she fetches.
You have a cat that fetches?
Yes.
That's really cool.
Yeah, but it's not a it's not learned. It's just she did it. Some cats do that.
They fetch?
They bring you stuff back because they just like chasing stuff.
But they bring it back.
Here she is, bringing it back.
Because she
It's incessant because she won't stop ever. Anyway, this guy was like saying, you know, you can't just shut people out and unfollow people and unfriend people because you disagree with them. You should have a dialogue and all that. And I was like, yeah, but I've had that dialogue for a long time now, and I'm done. I can vote.
Yeah.
I can vote.
So I'm convinced I'm good.
I mean, like the Bernie Hillary thing, I didn't give a shit about. I was like, I don't care which of these two people is the Democratic nominee. I will vote for them.
To me, the echo chamber is frustrating because it seems as though nobody really wants to hear the other side. But importantly, the Trump thing, he's like a person that was born to make everyone else crazy. He's that kid who's like the rubber and glue. It's like, no, the sky is blue. No, it's not. No. Yeah, it's blue. No, no, it's not. It's not blue.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's blue, for Christ's sake. And so there are facts that he just doesn't want to, that he ignores and his followers ignore. And the debate, I feel, is like useless at this point.
No, it is, because, I mean, all the people who were Trump supporters before, you poll them and they say he won the debate.
Which is insane. Okay, so...
But that's debate. The presidential debate, as long as I've been alive, has been a waste of fucking time.
Yeah.
Because there's never a real debate that happens. You know? It's not... There's never an exchange of ideas. It's just a list of bullet points.
It seems to be a presentation of who seems presidential, who appears appealing to you in terms of, if you want to watch someone speak for 4 or 8 years, potentially... Can you deal with this person the way they speak?
Right, right.
Nobody could deal with Nixon's sweaty lip. And, you know, he was also a total crook. But then, you know, the first televised debate, they say, is historic because Kennedy was a brilliant man, and he was also very telegenic. So he appeared on television.
That's true.
Very presidential. And Nixon did not at all. And so they say that that had a lot to do with the upswing for Kennedy after that. Televised
it. Yeah, that makes total sense. And they say it's like it has nothing to do with the words they say. It's all their body language.
And now they have the unbroken view of them while they're speaking. So you can totally undid Al Gore when he was sighing the whole time.
Right.
And rolling his eyes and sighing. And that was one of the first times I'd ever done that split screen thing.
Right.
So everybody, you can see the reaction. And back in the day, that wasn't really the case. They would have the candidate who's speaking and the other one just off camera. But now it's like you're on a reality TV show now. You're on Big Brother.
Right.
And everyone's watching you react. And so now they have to coach themselves on how to react or not react. Mostly not react.
Yeah. Don't react. Don't drink your water.
Yeah.
Don't sniff.
That was hilarious also. Someone said it was a cocaine sniff. It would be great if Donald Trump had a cocaine sniff.
Yeah, that would be great. You know, I wouldn't put it past him.
I just think that I want the whole campaign thing to be... The whole campaigning system to be completely remade. In Canada?
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong? Or in the UK? Is it both the UK and Canada? It's something like 6 to 8 weeks tops that the campaign starts.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
That'd be great.
This is ridiculous at this point.
Yeah.
And my wife and I had a baby this year, so we've generally tuned this out, and it's still annoying to
me. Yeah.
And crazy-making.
Yeah.
So I cannot imagine somebody who's like a devoted NPR listener or devoted Fox News person every day dealing with this, like, agita, you know? Like,
yeah, it is, and it's aggravating. I mean, and when I, like, read stuff, people I know who support Trump on social media or whatever... Like, that's aggravating, too. There's no point in these dialogues that this guy said I should have. Because there is no point. The dialogue is not... It's not going to happen.
Yeah, and he's not undecided. You're not undecided. What I think is an interesting... Many, like... things have been completely unearthed because of this, and a lot of white privilege has been just challenged and shattered, and a lot of very liberal people are finally seeing systemic racism for what it is. There might be a silver lining to all of this in that way. And it's like, look, this all opened up a lot of dialogue about race relations, a lot of dialogue about equality of gender pay, many, all these kind of issues in a real sense, not just in a sense of like, yeah, I'm liberal and I support the African American community. It's like, no, you're liberal, but you don't really see what the systemic racism is. So I think there might be a silver lining to all of this bullshit, historically speaking, down the line.
Yeah, I mean, the scary side is the level of bigotry that really does exist and has been squashed by political correctness.
Yeah.
And the power of political correctness, I really think, in the realm of being employed.
Just like,
you don't, you people get fired for being openly bigoted.
Yeah.
You know, so political correctness, all these people who felt like they didn't have a voice because they don't consider themselves to be racist or whatever, right, had to be quiet because of political correctness.
And now they're angry as hell.
And Trump has given them the voice.
That's what I was going to say, is that there's an enormous rage in this, whoever Trump's supporting demographic is, mostly, what is it, working class white people.
Right.
There's an anger there, and I think it frustrates a lot of everybody else. Why are you angry? You're a white, working class, middle class person. But there's something going on. There's a rise of the life expectancy of the average working class white person went down for the first time in 100 years, something like that. So what's happening there?
I think like Bernie, you know, and I liked a lot of the stuff Bernie said.
Yeah.
My only concern about Bernie was I don't really understand how he was going to accomplish all these things.
Yeah.
Because there's such a drastic turn. But that's what Trump is pitching. Trump is pitching weird, drastic solutions to, you know, what he considers to be the big problems.
My other problem with Bernie was foreign policy. I didn't really see that he had... he wanted to disengage to some degree.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that. I think that we're too entangled in a lot of things that we've created. And it's going to take a long time for us to actually pull our forces out of certain situations. It's a lot more complicated, I think.
Well, I think I agree. I think he's concerned about this same kind of disenfranchisement that Trump is making, his campaign about. And Hillary, lover or hater, is the establishment.
Yeah.
I mean, she's the establishment. The thing is if we really want this like revolutionary change to happen overnight, regardless, it's going to fuck so much shit up.
But it can't also be done by a president. There's only so much one president can actually do in that regard. Like you're saying, Bernie has these great ideas. How could he have actually implemented them given the system of checks and balances in our government? There are some trade issues or some foreign policy things he could have done. But how much power does a president as an individual really have, honestly? Especially somebody who's more on one wing or the other. They're not going to be... They're potentially going to have a hard time moving things through with the other branches of government. I mean, Obama even said it himself. Like, our government is designed for incremental change. And it was actually designed to prevent other revolutions from happening. Because revolutions are like bloody business. It's not like a fun thing that you really want to happen all the time.
No.
Our revolution was kind of weirdly went well compared to like the French Revolution and other things that happened in history. You see it all the time. Like, oh, well, this leader dissolved this parliament and they're going to have I mean, that never happens in the United States for a reason, so that there's relative stability. But in that relative stability, a lot of people have been disenfranchised and left behind at this point. So now it's like, okay, we're on the verge of having to like do another paradigm shift. And it feels like it's taking a long time. But hey, guess what? In 5 years, look back to 2000 and see how much has changed. And it's like, you'd be surprised how much has actually changed. It seems like a long time.
Yeah.
But that's the safe way to do things, so that there's not an actual revolution.
Right.
I don't know. I guess I'm more centrist in that way. But it, to me, it's like, do we really... Like, I went to Brazil one time, and I got this tour of like, a rich neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And the guy's driving me around, and there were... every mansion, it seemed, in this neighborhood had a 15 to 20 foot wall with razor wire and a turret with an armed guard.
Jeez.
Like, what is that about? And he's like, well, you know, there's some crime.
The purge was happening.
Yeah, well, I got there the week before the purge. And he's like, there's a lot of crime. There's a lot of corporate kidnappings that happen. But
sure.
Also, every now and then, the government is destabilized, and you want to be armed to protect yourself from the government. And I was like, that, to me, is a batshit crazy notion. And there are people, like I said before, that are building militias in this country who believe that that will happen.
That will happen.
But
yeah.
Most of us don't believe that that will happen, which would be like Red Dawn or something. But you know what I mean? Like, you don't want... That's... We have lived in a system that is designed to prevent that kind of shit from happening.
Yeah, well, the last thing... can you imagine another civil war?
No.
I mean...
No. That, I mean, and I also like to look back at things like, hey, 50 years ago was this. 50 years ago, you know, like when my parents were born, or sorry, when my parents got married, it was the 1960s. 100 years before that was the Civil War. That's not that long.
No, it's not, when you think about it.
So, our country's still recovering from...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what, like, so much of this is, this racial tension is about that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's weird, too, because so much time has gone by. So, you know, disenfranchised white people are like, why is this my problem? I never had a slave. I wasn't alive then.
That's not the issue, eh?
That's not the issue, and... Yeah, we've come a good ways, but not nearly far enough.
And the pendulum always swings. When something progressive happens, there's always a
backlash, yeah.
Trump, to me, seems to be a pretty obvious racist backlash to having the first black president for 8 years.
Yeah.
You know, there was the Tea Party, which everyone says, that's not racist. It's not a racist reaction. It's like, okay. But then Trump absolutely is.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But Trump supporters are like, no, he's not.
But
he's just speaking his mind.
But he as a man is racist. So if you back a racist president whose only policies that he's put forward are based on racial profiling, you're kind of implicitly supporting racist and racist policies. Sorry, you might not think you're racist, but if that guy wants to do stop and frisk, which is based on racial profiling, that's racist. It is. And that supports 50 to 100 and 200 years worth of bias.
Right.
That we're trying to change, and stop and frisk is not going in the right direction.
Well, it's like that that was already implemented and it failed miserably. Why would you want to bring it back?
Yeah, I lived in New York at the time, and I remember coming back from college, and my dad and I were going to a game at Yankee Stadium, and the old Yankee Stadium had this gap in the right field wall, basic fence, where you'd see an elevated train subway going
uh-huh.
by. And when I was a kid, it always looked like the Sesame Street cliche covered in graffiti
uh-huh.
subway, you know?
Yeah.
Like the Warriors cliche
uh-huh.
on the subway, the 1980s. And then I get back in the late 1990s, and this gleaming, clean subway car goes by, and I remember being like, what?
Oh.
What's up with that?
Yeah, New York, because I don't get back there very often, but I went to school there in the early 90s, and because I think the early 90s was the end of, I like looking at old, you know who Frank Henenlotter is?
No.
He's a filmmaker, he made low-budge, you know, exploitation films.
Uh-huh.
Basket Case is an example. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
This is a movie about a guy who has a a conjoined twin. Is that the right word?
Uh-huh.
But the twin is just like a face
uh-huh.
with like arms
is
that sticks out that like sticks out of the side of him. And then they in a kind of underground operation. They remove him, but he's still psychically connected.
Shit, I have to stop writing my script now. That's exactly what I was writing. God damn it. Stop.
Sorry, man.
Well, it's different enough. Okay, anyway.
So he's his conjoined twin, they huck him in a dumpster.
Oh, God.
You know, because they think he's dead or whatever. But he's telepathically linked to his brother.
Of course.
And so his brother fishes him out of the dumpster. Ugh. And then the guy's like, we got to go to New York, his weird brother. And he puts him in a basket and travels around with his brother, his uh-huh. brother that's just a head, in a basket. Uh-huh. His brother's name is Blyle.
Uh-huh.
And then they go on a murder spree.
Oh.
Getting revenge on
the
people
that.
Who cut them in half. Well, Blyle's problematic.
So you're saying stop and frisk would have potentially stopped Blyle and his brother?
Well, no, they were white guys, so it wouldn't have mattered. But what I was saying is, so he made movies like that and all this crazy stuff, but they're all set in like the seediest elements of 1980s New York.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't, like, there's such great, and another guy, I'm blanking on his name, he made the It's Alive movies, Larry Cohen, I think his name is. I think I'm getting that right. Yeah, Cohen. But he made a movie called Q, the Winged Serpent.
Oh, wow.
A movie called It's Alive about a killer baby.
Uh-huh.
Made a movie...
Baby?
Made a movie called The Stuff, which is about killer yogurt.
Oh, good.
You know, you don't want to eat that shit.
No.
Lots of movies like that. But they're all set in that New York, and they're low-budget movies, so they're shooting... It's like, at the time, it was set in present-day New York, and you see that seedy New York that doesn't... And I got that, you know, with Times Square filled with porn theaters and transvestite prostitutes.
My brother was mugged in Yankee Stadium in 1981.
There you go.
Going to the bathroom.
Yeah, getting mugged was everybody, my freshman year at NYU, everybody got mugged.
Oh, yeah.
It was a rite of passage.
But then all of a sudden, I'm living there in the late 1990s, and there's stop and frisk, and the quote-unquote quality of life laws. You can't have the squeegee guys asking you when you stop to squeegee your windshield. Do you know this whole thing?
Do they get rid of those guys?
They did, or they tried. It's one of those things, like, it's a nuisance to white people, so get rid of this kind of bullshit. And, you know, and my dad would get pissed. My dad would be like, I didn't ask for that. Ah, okay, here's $5. But then, you know, it was the stop and frisk went too far, and it was abused, and there were several innocent men that were murdered by the police.
Right.
One guy, Amadou Diallo, that whole situation. It was like, what's going on here? But then suddenly the crime rate went down and blah, 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 blah. But unclear as to whether that was connected to stop and frisk. At the same time, it was a massive violation of personal civil rights.
Yeah.
So, to me, the fact that this is still
a
on the table.
Yeah.
It is crazy making. It's just so frustrating.
Well, and the people, like, I didn't like Giuliani.
When
I was there, and I don't like what he did to New York. I don't I liked the seedy elements of New York.
It was
liked
completely whitewashed. I mean, in every sense of the term. It was like, the artists all fled because there was nowhere to.
No, when I was there, there was nothing in Soho except artist lofts. There was one bar next to a fortune cookie factory. It had no name, and they played reggae music, and the only thing they served was Red Stripe. That was the only place...
Not Tecate.
...in Soho. And if you walked around there at night, it was a ghost town. It was creepy, like cobblestone streets and everything, and there's nobody around. Yeah. And it's like, whoa, this is weird, because I knew I worked with a director who lived there, so we would sometimes rehearse at her place. But I went back there, I don't know, you know, maybe 10 years ago for a commercial.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to, because the union rules, they have to spend more money on your travel and accommodations that they actually do in paying you.
Yeah.
So they're like, put you up at a, you're going to be at this fancy hotel in Soho. And I was like, what?
Really?
Fancy hotel in Soho?
Next to the Fortune Cookie Factory?
Well, that's what I'm like. I'm like, I don't remember a fancy hotel in Soho. And I get there, and I get to the hotel, I'm like, holy shit, this is a fancy. Are you sure this is Soho? Because there were stores and bars and restaurants and cafes everywhere.
It's completely different.
Yeah, it's insane.
People ask me, "Where you're from New York, where should I go for dinner?" I'm like, I have no, are you kidding? I have no idea.
I think Mamoun's Falafel is still there.
Really?
So if you want a falafel, you can go to Mamoun's.
Oh, thank God.
That place is great.
And the whole, like, the Hudson River along the riverside was just derelict. It was, there were, like, melted. One of the coolest things ever was driving down the, is it the FDR? Yeah. Or is that on the east side? Anyway, you're one of the, what a New Yorker I am. But there was this... pier that was metal, probably like an old, built in the early 1900s pier.
Mm-hmm.
That was a boating pier, like shipping thing. And there had been a fire there, and it was melted, twisted metal. It looked like somebody's art project, like some kind of.
I never saw that.
Well, it was gone by the 1990s, but all of the late 70s and 80s, it was there. And I remember looking at it, and my mind just a flight of fancy, and what kind of like battle between Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus
that would happen on that. Yeah.
So that to me was like, that was New York City. That was the what the waterfront looked like, and now it's, you know, promenades and people walking and jogging, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, like, people can just jog.
What do you mean you're jogging here?
Wait, yeah, you'll be killed.
This is for drug dealers. What are you doing?
Well, yeah, Washington Square Park, which is where my dorm was on the park freshman year, it was full of drug dealers. They're all gone now.
But growing, I mean, my parents would always talk about how beautiful it was in the 50s and 60s and then how it just completely declined. And I just expected that it would just continue on to decline and look like Escape from New York.
Right, yeah.
I never expected it to bounce back.
No.
But then the bounce back completely changed its character.
Well, it's just like a tourist paradise now.
I lived in downtown L.A. for a while, and it's happening there now, too, and rapidly.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, yeah, it's definitely happening here, too. I used to live in Palms.
Oh, you know,
in walking distance. What, Ginny? What? I don't have your bracelet.
Throw me my bracelet.
Go get your bracelet, Ginny. I'll throw it. When we moved there, you know, because our apartment was walking distance of downtown Culver City.
Oh, yeah.
Which, at the time, was the Culver Hotel, and then there was a cafe called the Grand Casino Cafe, which I think is still there. It's an Argentinian place. We used to go there all the time. And then there was a little Italian place called Novecento, which had this great creamy bacon pasta thing.
Alfredo?
It was so good. Yeah. I don't know what... No, it wasn't Alfredo. It was like a cream sauce, but it had bacon in it. Mm. It was so fucking good. I want to go there right now.
The Heartstopper?
Yeah, it was the Heartstopper.
But
so
in Italian.
Bad
for... How do you say that in Italian? I forgot how you say that in Italian.
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'd have to ask my wife. She speaks Italian. I don't. But that's all that was there. You know, if you wanted to walk to a place to get a drink... You were either going to the Italian place for a glass of wine, or you'd go to the Culver Hotel, which in the lobby had like a little bar
that was
half the time it was closed,
and
they'd try to reopen it and start a new thing. That's all that was there. And then there was that multiplex, which I think is an Arclight now, but it
That's
used to
really
be like
nice.
A Pacific or whatever. But when they opened that at the time, it was like a big deal. They built it expecting the Culver Hotel to get torn down.
Oh.
Which was the plan. But then some people who were involved at the hotel got historic status. So it couldn't be torn down. It's a historic building. So that fucked the movie theater.
Right.
Nobody knew the movie theater was there because there's a giant hotel in front of it.
Yeah. But that's really pretty, though.
Well, now it's so built up.
Yeah.
Like, we watched downtown Culver City go from essentially a weird ghost town... into this place where hipsters hang out at wine bars and all that
stuff. Palms is adjacent to all that, and it's a real thing.
Yeah, it's just on the other side of Venice.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, then Venice, I mean, Christ, that's so crazy what's happening over there.
Yeah.
And again, I'm like, I've been here for 10 years, and I still don't feel like an Angeleno so much. I mean, I do and I don't, because I lived in a few different neighborhoods, but I've never lived on... in the Venice. I've never done the Venice thing. I feel like that's a rite of passage that you should have lived in Venice for like a year.
Oh yeah, I have friends who have lived there. Yeah, I never lived there, but I you know.
But now it's like a Silicon Valley situation, and the houses they're building there don't look like the 70s and 80s, you know.
No, well, in the 80s, Venice was gang territory.
Yeah. So,
because my wife is a, you know, born and raised here.
Where?
In Los Angeles. Well, yeah, her dad was a variety television director.
Oh, yeah.
So they had lots and lots of money, and she lived in Hancock Park.
Oh, good.
And then they lost all their money, and there's no... Like, we drive through Hancock Park every now and then to look at her old mansion.
Wow.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You knock on the door, can I see my old room?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But... So she, you know, when she was a kid, she didn't go to Venice.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, when I moved downtown, people said that. They're like, what are you doing down there? Because I lived right on Theater Row, that old historic Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And my building was built in 1912. It was really cool. And they were lofts that I guess hadn't sold. And so they started renting them for not too bad to entice people to come down. And I always felt like when I'd go downtown that it was like this secret still, that nobody knew. There's some awesome restaurants that were down there, and because I felt like they got carte blanche to be like, just make this something nice, make this right. Something good. And they would shoot a lot of movies when I was down there. I remember one night walking from a bar home past like the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man set and some television show, and then
poor Andrew Garfield.
Oh yeah,
he got screwed.
He just wasn't fun.
You know, I actually thought he was good. It's just the movies weren't good.
He's a good actor. He wasn't nerdy enough for me as Peter Parker.
He was a little too cool.
He was a skateboarder.
He was a little too Deadpool and not enough Spider-Man. Cool. Yeah.
And there was a lot of crying. I guess Tobey Maguire cried a lot. But there was like a lot of Spider-Man crying.
Yeah, that's just a trend, I feel like, in comic book movies these days. I mean,
you're not a comic book movie guy.
No, I mean, I see him all because my kid likes him.
Yeah.
But the... Marvel still got at least some lightheartedness to it and a sense of humor, you know, which is... those movies are just more fun because of that. But, like, the DC ones... just the fact that they keep giving Zack Snyder...
I know
I'm not supposed to talk shit about people who could potentially hire me, but... you know, and I liked his remake of Dawn of the Dead a lot.
What'd you think about the Nolan Batman?
There was stuff I liked about it, but no. The whole thing is just too goddamn dour.
Yeah.
And he's the one who started that, and then Snyder is basically imitating him with all the Superman stuff.
To me, it works with Batman, the character.
Sure, it makes more sense for Batman to be dour, sure, yes.
And he's the more... Yeah, but it doesn't make sense for Superman. He has a bright red cape. This is for little kids. Like, you're selling Legos and soda with his picture on it. And, no, when you see, like, Christian Bale Batman on the side of a Slurpee, you're like, that doesn't really make any sense.
No, I remember when I saw The Dark Knight, which... You know, I thought was three quarters of a great movie.
Yeah. Too long for you?
Yeah. The you don't need it more than Joker. You don't need Two-Face in that shit.
For me,
you don't need Aaron Eckhart stumbling around being Two-Face. Fuck that.
Here's my theory. What do you think about that? Okay. My nephews, who are now not into it, I don't think anymore. One of them is, but the other two are in high school. But they used to be obsessed with the... Lego video games that were Lego Star Wars, Lego Batman.
Oh, yeah, my kid likes those, yeah.
Because you can collect, like, 100 different characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think those superhero movies should be, like, 4 hours long. And with 100 characters in them. Like, Lord of the Rings. Because little kids, especially little boys, will go over and over again to, like, clock who is who and to chart it out in their mind. And, like, I want to see that part again.
I'm fine with that if the movies were okay for little boys.
Because
when I saw The Dark Knight, I was like, the fact that this got a PG-13 rating
Yeah.
Is insane to me.
It was brutal.
I mean, yeah, they weren't cursing and there's no nudity, but the violence and themes of that movie are so dark.
You didn't take your son to that, did you?
Or, oh, no. Was like, yeah. It was too young. He's seen it now. Okay. He's 10. He's seen it now. But I just, at the time, I was like...
Yeah.
I mean, and we're not particularly good about the movie. Like, we were...
You're not, like, the super strict about...
No, we've shown him certain R-rated movies and stuff like that. Yeah. Because, honestly, because good. They remake... these movies is PG-13 movies, and I'm like, oh, he's going to wind up seeing this remake, reboot piece of shit before he sees the original good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and of course there's lines. I won't let him see RoboCop. You know, but there's some stuff that I've shown him, you know. I let him see Die Hard, which is, wall-to-wall cursing and kind of gory, but...
There's some blood, yeah.
But... I was like...
But that's basically what a PG-13 movie is now.
Yeah, and it dawned on me because he was seeing some action movies that are just rip-offs of Die Hard. They're still making them.
But Die Hard has actual blood, and it seems like the violence has consequences.
That's the thing, too. Yeah.
That PG-13 thing that's weird for me is like, that guy's fine. Oh, but he has a broken neck. But don't worry about it. We'll never see him again.
Yeah.
That guy got stabbed by Wolverine's claws, but there's no blood, of course.
Yeah.
He's fine.
He's fine.
It's fine. He got him in the airbag. He stabbed him in the airbag.
Right.
I think there's a level of brutality that's just sort of like accepted now, whether it's just our culture moving in that direction or whatever. Things are just more brutal.
More brutal and more bleak.
Yeah.
You know,
if I see another 9/11 thing in a I can't believe I'm still watching
movies with collapse. That imagery. Yeah.
Buildings collapsing. Like, just think of something else. I know that disasters usually involve a building collapsing, I guess.
Right.
On that scale.
But they always use that. Like, even in a movie as dumb as 2012, they used that imagery to pull an emotional response out of you.
Of course.
And it's a cheap trick.
Yeah.
In 2012, of course, it doesn't work, because 2012, which is one of my favorite all-time disaster movies...
Really?
Is because it's so ludicrous.
Wait, which one was that again?
That's the one with John Cusack.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it came out in like 2008 or 9, like a few years before.
I saw it in the theater.
Oh, yeah. It's so much fun.
It is a lot of fun.
And it really is. It doesn't even have an actual story arc. It's just people running from the disasters.
It's set pieces, yeah.
Yeah, and they just switch vehicles. They start in a limo.
Limo.
And then they get in a small plane.
Yeah.
And then they get in a larger RV.
Yeah.
And then they get in a larger plane. And they're just outrunning everything. It reminded me when Twister came out, Letterman had this run. Because, you know, Letterman would just stick to the same joke for months.
I miss him.
I miss him too. But he had a whole bit about Twister, and he's like...
Mailman.
Oh, the mailman's here.
Thanks.
I got some kind of package.
He has a pith helmet on.
Well, he's serious about his job.
And he's an archaeologist.
Yeah. Okay. And he digs in the dirt and delivers mail. It's his thing.
From the past.
He said that Twister, he's like, this new movie, Twister, is sweeping the nation. It's a huge hit. It's a movie about a family that gets attacked by a twister, and then they move, and the twister keeps following them around the country. But that's what 2012 is.
It's a great
It's a
line.
Family running from disasters. It's exactly that.
Did you know they were going to make that into a TV series?
2012?
Yeah. They were going to carry on from the end of the movie, like creating a new society. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen 2012.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
Creating a new society based on that big arc.
Look, I have no desire to see another show about people rebuilding society after an apocalypse. But if Steve McCaddy is in it, I will fucking watch it.
Who's Steve McCaddy?
Steve McCaddy is Canada's Lance Henriksen.
Okay. Who's awesome.
Yeah. Steve McCaddy in 2012 is the captain of the Ark that John Cusack sneaks onto.
I'm sure I would know who this is when I see his face.
Yeah. He's, if you've not... Do you like zombie movies? You're zombied out. But if you're willing to give an indie zombie movie a chance, It's a chamber piece, really. It's called Pontypool, and it's about a shock jock, like a aging shock jock, who, you know, takes this shitty job in a small town in Canada called Pontypool. And it's just him doing a show and talking to callers, you know, and berating people about this, that, and the other thing.
This is a movie?
Yeah, and then, like, ripping society apart from it. But then slowly he's realizing something is fucking going on in Pontypool. And then it becomes this, like, emergency. He's, like, doing an emergency broadcast, and people are calling in and die. So you never really see the zombie outbreak happen. You just hear it.
It's like a War of the Worlds thing, kind of.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
And 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah, but it was way better than 10 Cloverfield Lane.
That's a cool idea.
Don't get me started on 10
Cloverfield
Lane.
Are you ever
going to
make, like, a thing? You should make... Are you ever going to make, like, a genre... Like a zombie thing or a disaster thing or something like that?
For what?
I mean, would you ever, like, produce something like that? Get some buddies together, make a short, do something like that?
Sure.
You should.
I would do that. Yeah, that would be fun.
Because we both do comedy, but it's also, like, I'm dying to do, like, a Game of Thrones type of thing.
Oh, yeah. I relish when I get to be, like, sometimes, you know, once every couple of years, I'll get a guest star where I'm a murderer or something.
Yeah. Well, the comedy guys are always good murderers because we have that perverse sense of... We have that glint in our eye.
That's true. I guess that's true. Yeah, maybe that's why.
When I got here, I was doing... I did some student films to get some footage. And I'd go in to play the very nice husband.
Yeah.
Or the complete psychopath murderer.
Yeah. A couple years ago, I actually made... two short films that friends of mine were making. They asked me to be in it, and I was like, yeah, sure. But they were both zombie shorts. One was comedic, and it's called Dog Catchers. It's probably online
somewhere. Oh, wait,
was
Scott Pete?
No. It was it's a true backyard production. We shot basically all of it in my friend Frank Stokes' backyard. And he flew... Do you know what Rusty Schwimmer is?
No.
She's a character actress. She's been around.
No, who's he?
Yeah. She's a character actress. She's been around forever.
Okay.
She was in a lot of disaster movies, actually.
Cool.
She was in The Perfect Storm. The Perfect Storm. Her and John Hawks. You know John Hawks?
Yeah, oh yeah.
They were, you know, like, had a flirtatious relationship. Like,
all
she
these,
was...
I'm obviously terrible with names, and so all of these people, I'm like, oh, yeah, of course.
If you saw her, you would recognize her.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was me and her just in a backyard, cool. And the idea is the dog catchers have become zombie eradicators.
Yeah.
We catch the zombies.
Cool.
So we're in a backyard trying to catch
a
zombie.
What was the other one?
And the other one was called Butterfly Dust, and that was serious. It was not jokey, but it all took place in a lab on an island, and the idea was it was a lab where they were researching how to make women look younger and more beautiful, but then the formula they created had a bad side effect.
What bad batch?
Which turns them into zombies.
That's a great... I love it.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's a great conceit.
And I was the guy... My character I loved in that because I was the guy... Because that drives me nuts in zombie movies where they always have to figure out... Like, everybody has to figure shit out every time there's a new zombie movie.
We know that what zombies
You got to shoot them in the head and all that crap.
Right.
So this guy, my character, right away is like, what the fuck are you guys even talking about? You know? We gotta get guns and get out of here and shoot everybody. Yeah. These are fucking zombies. And they're like, no, these are people. They were test subjects and there's been a bad side effect. No, it doesn't matter anymore.
It can be cured.
Yeah,
it can
no,
be
it
saved.
Doesn't matter. Yes, this is our fault. It doesn't matter anymore.
Too late. Run!
Yeah, stop being humanitarian. They're zombies.
I love the fascination with zombie. I'm sure people have written dissertations about why we're so fascinated with that whole thing.
Oh, sure.
It's like a disease fear.
Yeah, and modern zombies, and the first person to tell you this would be Romero, because he created the modern zombie with Night of the Living Dead, is that they're not really zombies. They're ghouls.
What?
Well, a zombie, originally...
Go on.
I'm going to get real nerdy.
Okay, good.
The original... The concept of the zombie... is Haitian in its origins.
Okay.
And if you let, if the first ever zombie movie is White Zombie, okay, with Bela Lugosi, which Rob Zombie named his band after.
Ah.
But that movie's about a guy who keeps zombies. And the zombies, did you ever see Serpent and the Rainbow or read the book?
No.
That's what it is about, like real life zombies. But basically, they're people who are drugged.
Yeah.
And enslaved because the drug makes them, turns them into what, you know, brain dead.
Ooh,
you
know, truly. Yeah.
But they never ate people.
Right.
You know, they were just, you know, walking the earth.
Not till bath salts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but that's what the original zombie was yeah, just a person who had no emotion and could be made to do work.
But they were harmless.
They're harmless, essentially, yeah. So like Serpent in the Rainbow is about a guy investigating, trying to find that drug, you know, for whatever reason. You know, but then they'll give you the drug and it seems like you're dead, and then they bury you, and then you wake up and you're in a grave.
So what's a ghoul then?
Well, the ghoul is what, because Night of the Living Dead, they're called the Living Dead. They're never called zombies. In any of Romero's movies, they're not called zombies.
They're the undead.
They're the undead, which an undead person is a ghoul originally.
Okay.
But for whatever reason, people were calling them zombies. Did you see that zombie movie? Did you see that zombie movie? So it stuck. So the modern zombie isn't really a zombie. It's a ghoul.
It's like how people call hot tubs jacuzzis, but it's really...
Right.
Jacuzzi's a brand name that caught on.
Right. And the reason why they got married is because of the original zombie that get drugged. You know, it's like a revenge thing, and then people will get buried and quote-unquote rise from the dead, but they're not dead.
Yeah.
They seem dead.
That reminds me of, I worked with a makeup artist who had to apply like a rash to my body. So it was about an hour long process of painting on this bubbly skin and then stippling it with red paint.
It's cool.
He's a cool guy. And he said that his first job was working on Thriller, the Michael Jackson video.
Oh, wow.
And they needed people for these added shots that John Landis added in. So they painted each other. And he said he's the guy that comes out and all like the black oil comes out of his mouth. He's the guy that rises from the grave. And he was like maybe 20 years old or something when that happened.
What's the name of that guy who is... Have we mentioned on this recording that we worked together on a kid show?
We did not.
We worked together on a kid show called Just Add Magic.
On Amazon Prime.
On Amazon Prime.
We're dads.
Yeah, we're dads. You're a sweet dad, and I'm like a... Like
you're
the weird, like if you
kind of sweet dad.
I tried. Somebody posted. They were like, "Hey, I saw you on that Just Add Magic. It's a sweet show about sweet kids and you, a deadbeat dad." Because if you really like break it down, I'm kind of a dad, you know.
You take her camping.
That's true, but deadbeat, you know, in essence of I'm unemployed, and my daughter has to get me a job, you know.
The daughters have a lot of agency on this show. They're very proactive young ladies.
Well, that's what a kid show should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're making it happen. We're but just like witnessing their greatness.
Yeah. When they help us, and that's good, but at least we're not like the buffoonish parents that are on like Disney kid shows.
Right.
And all
we're
that.
Not we are unaware, but we're not clueless.
Right.
How about that?
Yeah. We're good parents, but we have no idea what our kids are really up to.
The magic and mischief that happens behind the scenes.
Which is true about parenting in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't necessarily know what the kids are up to. But I bring it up because there's, and I'm blanking on his name, but one of the guys who works crew on it, I think an art department guy, I want to say. I was talking to him, and he... worked on Tombstone.
Really?
Yeah. And Val Kilmer and Kurt Russell both like took a shine to him at the time. They liked him. And they kept saying, we got to get you in the movie.
Oh, cool.
So do you remember the movie?
A little bit, yeah.
So there's a scene in an opium den, you know, because Kurt Russell's always doing the opium. And he's
hooked on the opium.
Yeah, and in the scene, there's a guy who's like wasted on opium, and you know, Kurt Russell smokes his opium out of his gun, like it puts the barrel of the gun in his mouth, and you know, the hot gun, and sucks the whatever, the opium smoke or whatever.
That's how people do it, yeah.
And he's the guy who, like, stumbles in and Kurt Russell's passed out, and he takes a hit off the gun.
Oh, my God. I have to go back and look.
And he's not an actor, so he was saying to Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer, he's like, guys, I can't play this wasted dude. And they're like, we'll take care of it. So Val Kilmer and Kurt Russell got him shit-faced for reals and for him to do the scene.
You heard this all on the set of Just Add Magic?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's so fantastic. Yeah. That's fun. Why can't actors do that? They have to be a non-actor to get wasted?
No, I'm sure, well, you know.
He's method. That reminds me of the fact, on Twin Peaks, Bob the killer was the hairdresser. Was the hair artist.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and they said he was like the sweetest person in the world, but he just had this long, crazy hair and this kind of scary look.
Look, yeah, so they're like, let's put that in
so
the show.
So it was just like 60 frames per second with a strobe light, just scream, and he looked terrifying.
That's awesome.
Isn't that awesome? They say he was very nice, and they're cut, and he's like, was that good? Did I do it? Was it good?
Yeah. Well, that's like a classic.
He's like a very nice man.
With the exception of Dabney Coleman, who's played a lot of bad guys, and he is genuinely an asshole. And I say that publicly, without apology, and without worries.
Oh, Coleman's coming for you.
he's deaf anyway. He can't hear a thing. He's not listening to podcasts. Ugh. But he was such a jerk. But usually the bad guys are, they turn out to be the sweetest guys. Like that bald dude from Hills Have Eyes.
Oh, God.
You know, that crazy looking bald. And he was in Weird Science and stuff.
Yeah.
He's like the nicest guy in the world.
Well, I love him in Weird Science where he's like, okay, I love what you've done.
But that's what he really is like. Yeah, he's a really nice guy.
Who else? There was one. It just came and went in and out of my brain. Michael Keaton actually talked about how, he's not a bad guy, but he said when he came back from shooting Batman every day, he was like zippity-doo-dah in a good mood with his family because he got to be dark and brooding all day.
Yeah.
And when he's doing comedy, he said he'd come home exhausted, kind of like burned out from being happy or peppy all day.
Yeah, my aunt, one time I was back for the summer, and I do a lot of commercials.
Yeah.
And I always say commercial acting is sort of the opposite of what Stanislavski and Uta Hagen say is
don't
acting.
Don't even get me started.
Behaving truthfully in imaginary circumstances.
I think
acting is behaving in a very imagined way in completely ludicrous way. You know what I mean? It's like you're happy about hemorrhoids and stuff like that.
You're justifying a lot of fakey.
Yeah, and even when you're like the hardest commercial gigs I've had is when they've written very sarcastic copy. You know, and then they want you to play against the sarcasm, right. And it's like, but how? You wrote a sarcastic line, you want me to not be sarcastic? It's so confusing.
I get a sense that the people that wrote that would love to have written it for you're the worst.
Right.
You know, they want to write for this. So, but they're writing for advertising, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Just generalization. And then the client comes in, and they're afraid of the edge that really has. And so the note then is to make both of those camps happy.
Right.
And it's up to you. Go. Action.
Yeah, go. Action.
So the director takes you aside and whispers in your ear, I really want it to be this way, but the client really wants it.
Yeah, that happens
so
a lot.
Just give me a couple of takes on this end of the spectrum.
Right.
And then we'll go in and we'll do one for you.
Well, and being happy all day,
yeah,
you know, like being funny all day, it is, I think, more exhausting than brooding.
I completely agree.
And I went back. Like, I go on vacation, and I go back east and hang out with my family, and my aunt's like, yeah, I'm really worried about you. I haven't seen you smile very much. Are you not happy? And I was like, for one, who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm perfectly happy. I've had a lovely vacation. I'm relaxing. And let me explain to you that if I'm not smiling, it's because I'm on vacation. Because my job requires me to smile all the time.
Especially, another thing about commercials, it's always another first day at work.
Oh, yeah.
Every time. And a lot of crews have worked with each other many times, and you could have worked with them several times, but you're like the substitute teacher every time, and you're the new guy.
Yeah.
It's your first day every time.
Well, and people don't understand that, too. That's true about guest star work as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if recurring guest star work is a little bit different, because yeah. once you've gone through it once and you come back and people are familiar with you and they have confidence that you can do what you do, then it's more like being a series regular. But when you're just a one-off, one-day guest star, you feel very alone.
You know what's weird? I did a guest star on Criminal Minds where I played the husband of the murderer, and then she puts a knife in my back, which is great. We only worked together. The two guest stars. Our entire day was with each other. And then the series regulars come in and discover my dead body in the kitchen. So I never worked with anyone other than another guest star. So it felt like we were shooting a little indie film, like a little short film.
Yeah.
So that was...
That's different.
That was really different. That was really different. Fun.
Yeah.
And then a couple of other guest stars I've done have been in the first season of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like... They definitely know each other, but like they're still kind of feeling their way. They're getting to know each other, but then when you walk into like season 5 or 6 of something, and it's like, yeah, it's different.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and sometimes, I mean, I think like on You're the Worst, Jess at Magic is true this way too. Everybody's very welcoming.
Yeah,
and it seems like a lot of people are aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's the first day of school kind of feeling.
Yeah,
and like on some shows. You're the Worst is that way. I thought Will and Grace was actually that way.
Oh,
did an episode of that, and they were all very nice, you know. I mean, these huge TV stars, when I was on it, this is the biggest thing, they were nice.
Did you see the new thing that they made? They made a new Will and Grace scene about this election.
No.
It's fantastic. And they're, like, they slipped right back into it 10 years later.
That's great.
Everyone came back, evidently, the directors, the line producer, everyone.
Burroughs did it?
Yeah.
Because that's the whole reason I did the show. Yeah. I had, like, 2 lines, but it was a guest star because I was working with Madonna.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah. Her and Megan Mullally, you know, were vying for my attention on the dance floor, which is funny to have Megan Mullally, like, rubbing her butt on one leg, and then Madonna was humping my other leg.
Wow.
That was crazy. But the whole reason I did it was because James Burroughs
was directing.
Like, I just wanted to meet James Burroughs.
Dear 16-year-old star. Yeah.
Everybody's calling me like, what's Madonna like? I was like, she's weird. I don't care. James Burroughs is amazing.
That's cool.
He was amazing. Like, you know, he's this multicam, which is a thing that's really dying out now. But he is such a master of that venue. It was amazing. You'd rehearse the scene once, and you'd go, do this, this, this. And then you'd do it, and you'd be like, oh, shit.
Oh, good.
That makes that so much funnier.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that.
It's great. It has all the energy of the show. It's like a lot of this... The West Wing did it for one of the elections. They did another West Wing reunion, and it sort of just felt flat. It felt like an old band getting back together that doesn't quite...
Right, doesn't click.
But the Will and Grace cast is, like, the same. They look great, and they're just, like, sharp, and it's funny as hell. I loved it.
I gotta watch that.
You should watch it.
Yeah, I'm gonna watch it. Sounds good.
I'm a big Megan Mullally fan. Because I got to work with her and Nick Offerman on Parks and Rec. I never got to do anything with her, but we were on set on the same day.
Yeah.
Like, super fun. I mean, what a cool couple.
Yeah, they are cool. She's so funny. I was a big fan of Party Down. I don't know if you ever watched that show.
She was on the
second season, yeah.
That show seemed to be cannibalized for other shows. It's like, what a cast they had. And then they all got plucked out for network shows.
Right.
And then the show kind of... Well, I don't know.
Well, because Jane Lynch was on the first season, and then she got Glee.
Yeah.
And so Megan Mullally came in on the second season.
And look what they've all done.
And Adam Scott and Lizzie Kaplan and Ken Marino.
It's a cult classic.
And Martin, what's from Freaks and Geeks. Martin.
Oh, yeah. He's on Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah.
Really funny dude. But yeah. I wish that show had kept going. I thought it was such a genius idea for a show.
Was that Rob Thomas?
Think so, yeah. It was just brilliant. It was like every episode, it was a workplace comedy, but the workplace was always different.
Yeah.
It was hilarious.
You don't really need to know anything about... Well, that's the truth of any workplace comedy. You don't need to know anything about the actual work that they do, really.
No.
But it just gives you an opportunity for, like, other business, B-plots and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's always about, like, who's having sex with who and who's tension between people. It doesn't
right.
matter.
Yeah. It doesn't. It doesn't. So, do you have to wrap up your show? It's usually an hour, right?
Oh, my show? Yeah. I just want to thank Todd for being here.
Thanks
for having
me. I
really appreciate it, man. Next week, we'll have another special guest. As always, Tone Nation, thank you so much for listening. I'm Andrew Burleson, your host, and it's been a pleasure.